Chapter 5. For sufficient reasons, which this narrative will itself unfold as it advances, a fictitious name must be bestowed upon the old cathedral town. Let it stand in these pages as Cloisterham. It was once possibly known to the Druids by another name, and certainly to the Romans by another, and to the Saxons by another, and to the Normans by another, and a name more or less in the course of many centuries can be of little moment to its moldy chronicles. An ancient city, Cloisterham, and no meet dwelling place for anyone with hankerings after the noisy world. A monotonous, silent city, deriving an earthy flavor throughout from its cathedral crypt, and so abounding in vestiges of monastic graves, that the Cloisterham children grow small salad in the dust of abbots and abbesses, and make dirt pies of nuns and friars, while every ploughman in its outlying fields renders to once puissant lord treasurers, archbishops, bishops, and such like, the attention which the ogre in the storybook desired to render to his unbidden visitor, and grinds their bones to make his bread. A drowsy city, Cloisterham, whose inhabitants seem to suppose, with an inconsistency more strange than rare, that all its changes lie behind it, and that there are no more to come. A queer moral to derive from antiquity, yet older than any traceable antiquity. So silent are the streets of Cloisterham, though prone to echo on the smallest provocation, that of a summer day the sunblinds of its shops scarce dare to flap in the south wind, while the sun-browned tramps, who pass along and stare, quicken their limp a little, that they may the sooner get beyond the confines of its oppressive respectability. This is a feat not difficult of achievement, seeing that the streets of Cloisterham City are little more than one narrow street by which you get into it, and get out of it. The rest being mostly disappointing yards with pumps, in them and no thoroughfare exception made of the cathedral close, and a paved Quaker settlement, in color and general conformation very like a Quakeress's bonnet, up in a shady corner. In a word, a city of another, and a bygone time is Cloisterham, with its hoarse cathedral bell, its hoarse rooks hovering about the cathedral tower, its hoarser and less distinct rooks in the stalls far beneath. Fragments of old wall, saint's chapel, chapter house, convent, and monastery, have got incongruously or obstructively built into many of its houses and gardens, much as kindred jumbled notions have become incorporated into many of its citizens' minds. All things in it are of the past. Even its single pawnbroker takes in no pledges, nor has he for a long time, but offers vainly an unredeemed stock for sale, of which the costlier articles are dim, and pale old watches apparently in a slow perspiration, tarnished sugar tongs with ineffectual legs, and odd volumes of dismal books. The most abundant and the most agreeable evidences of progressing life in Cloisterham are the evidences of vegetable life in many gardens, even its drooping and despondent little theater as its poor strip of garden, receiving the foul fiend, when he ducks from its stage into the infernal regions, among scarlet beans or oyster shells, according to the season of the year. In the midst of Cloisterham stands the nun's house. A venerable brick edifice, whose present appellation is doubtless derived from the legend of its conventual uses. On the trim gate enclosing its old courtyard is a resplendent brass plate flashing forth the legend, Seminary for Young Ladies, Miss Twinkleton. Apostrophe the house front is so old and worn, and the brass plate is so shining and staring, that the general result has reminded imaginative strangers of a battered old beau with a large modern eyeglass stuck in his blind eye. Whether the nuns of yore, being of a submissive, rather than a stiff-necked generation, habitually bent their contemplative heads, to avoid collision with the beams, in the low ceilings of the many chambers of their house, whether they sat in its long low windows telling their beads for their mortification, instead of making necklaces of them for their adornment, whether they were ever walled up alive in odd angles, and jutting gables of the building for having some ineradicable leaven of busy mother nature, in them which has kept the fermenting world alive ever since, These may be matters of interest to its haunting ghosts, if any, but constitute no item in Miss Twinkleton's half-yearly accounts. They are neither of Miss Twinkleton's inclusive regulars, nor of her extras. The lady who undertakes the poetical department of the establishment at, so much or so little, a quarter has no pieces in her list of recitals bearing on such unprofitable questions as, in some cases of drunkenness, and in others of animal magnetism, there are two states of consciousness which never clash, but each of which pursues its separate course, as though it were continuous instead of broken. Thus, if I hide my watch when I am drunk, I must be drunk again before I can remember where. So Miss Twinkleton has two distinct and separate phases of being. Every night, the moment the young ladies have retired to rest, does Miss Twinkleton smarten up her curls a little, brighten up her eyes a little, and become a sprightlier Miss Twinkleton than the young ladies have ever seen. Every night, at the same hour, does Miss Twinkleton resume the topics of the previous night, comprehending the tenderer scandal of Cloisterham, of which she has no knowledge whatever by day, and references to a certain season at Tunbridge Wells,
airily called by Miss Twinkleton in this state of her existence the Wells,
notably the season wherein a certain finished gentleman,
compassionately called by Miss Twinkleton in this stage of her existence, foolish Mr. Porter's
revealed homage of the heart, whereof Miss Twinkleton, in her scholastic state of existence, is as ignorant as a granite pillar. Miss Twinkleton's companion in both states of existence, and equally adaptable to either, is one Mrs. Tisher, a deferential widow with a weak back, a chronic sigh, and a suppressed voice, who looks after the young lady's wardrobes, and leads them to infer that she has seen better days. Perhaps this is the reason why it is an article of faith with the servants, handed down from race to race, that the departed Tisher was a hairdresser. The pet pupil of the nun's house is Miss Rosebud, of course called Rosebud. Wonderfully pretty, wonderfully childish, wonderfully whimsical. An awkward interest,
awkward, because romantic,
attaches to Miss Bud in the minds of the young ladies, on account of its being known to them that a husband has been chosen for her by will and bequest, and that her guardian is bound down to bestow her on that husband when he comes of age. Miss Twinkleton, in her seminarial state of existence, has combated the romantic aspect of this destiny by affecting to shake her head over it behind Miss Bud's dimpled shoulders, and to brood on the unhappy lot of that doomed little victim. But with no better effect, possibly some unfelt touch of foolish Mr. Porter's has undermined the endeavor than to evoke from the young ladies an unanimous bedchamber cry of, "Oh, what a pretending old thing Miss Twinkleton is, my dear!" ... The nun's house is never in such a state of flutter as when this allotted husband calls to see little Rosebud.
It is unanimously understood by the young ladies that he is lawfully entitled to this privilege, and that if Miss Twinkleton disputed it, she would be instantly taken up and transported.
When his ring at the gate bell is expected, or takes place, every young lady who can, under any pretense, look out of window, looks out of window, while every young lady who is practicing, practices out of time, and the French class becomes so demoralized that the mark goes round as briskly as the bottle at a convivial party in the last century. On the afternoon of the day next after the dinner of two at the gatehouse, the bell is rung with the usual fluttering results. ... Mr. Edwin Drood to see Miss Rosa. ... This is the announcement of the parlor maid in chief. Miss Twinkleton, with an exemplary air of melancholy on her, turns to the sacrifice and says, "You may go down, my dear." ... Miss Bud goes down, followed by all eyes. Mr. Edwin Drood is waiting in Miss Twinkleton's own parlor, a dainty room, with nothing more directly scholastic in it than a terrestrial and a celestial globe.
These expressive machines imply to parents and guardians that even when Miss Twinkleton retires into the bosom of privacy, duty may at any moment compel her to become a sort of wandering Jewess, scouring the earth and soaring through the skies in search of knowledge for her pupils. The last new maid, who has never seen the young gentleman Miss Rosa is engaged to, and who is making his acquaintance between the hinges of the open door, left open for the purpose, stumbles guiltily down the kitchen stairs, as a charming little apparition, with its face concealed by a little silk apron thrown over its head, glides into the parlor. "Oh, it is so ridiculous!" apostrophe says the apparition, stopping and shrinking. "Don't, Eddie!" apostrophe, "don't what, Rosa? Apostrophe, don't come any nearer, please. It is so absurd." Apostrophe, "what is absurd, Rosa?" Apostrophe, "the whole thing is. It is so absurd to be an engaged orphan, and it is so absurd to have the girls and the servants scuttling about after one, like mice in the wainscot. And it is so absurd to be called upon." Apostrophe, the apparition appears to have a thumb in the corner of its mouth while making this complaint. "You give me an affectionate reception, pussy, I must say. Apostrophe, well, I will in a minute, Eddie, but I can't just yet. How are you?" Apostrophe, very shortly. "I am unable to reply that I am much the better for seeing you, pussy, inasmuch as I see nothing of you." Apostrophe, the second remonstrance brings a dark, bright, pouting eye out from a corner of the apron, but it swiftly becomes invisible again, as the apparition exclaims, "Oh good gracious, you have had half your hair cut off." Apostrophe, "I should have done better to have had my head cut off, I think," apostrophe says Edwin, rumpling the hair in question, with a fierce glance at the looking glass, and giving an impatient stamp. "Shall I go?" Apostrophe, "no, you needn't go just yet, Eddie. The girls would all be asking questions why you went." Apostrophe, "once for all, Rosa, will you uncover that ridiculous little head of yours, and give me a welcome?" Apostrophe, the apron is pulled off the childish head, as its wearer replies, "You're very welcome, Eddie. There. I'm sure that's nice. Shake hands." "No, I can't kiss you, because I've got an acidulated drop in my mouth." Apostrophe, "are you at all glad to see me, pussy?" Apostrophe, "oh, yes, I'm dreadfully glad. Go and sit down, Miss Twinkleton." Apostrophe, "it is the custom of that excellent lady when these visits occur, to appear every 3 minutes, either in her own person or in that of Mrs. Tisher, and lay an offering on the shrine of propriety, by affecting to look for some desiderated article. On the present occasion Miss Twinkleton, gracefully gliding in and out, says in passing, 'How do you do, Mr. Drood? Very glad indeed to have the pleasure. Pray excuse me. Tweezers. Thank you.' Apostrophe, I got the gloves last evening, Eddie, and I like them very much. They are beauties." Apostrophe, "well, that's something." Apostrophe, the affianced replies, half grumbling, "the smallest encouragement thankfully received. And how did you pass your birthday, pussy?" Apostrophe, "delightfully. Everybody gave me a present. And we had a feast. And we had a ball at night." Apostrophe, "a feast and a ball, eh? These occasions seem to go off tolerably well without me, pussy." Apostrophe, "delightfully." Apostrophe, cries Rosa, in a quite spontaneous manner, and without the least pretense of reserve. "Ha! And what was the feast?" Apostrophe, "tarts, oranges, jellies, and shrimps." Apostrophe, "any partners at the ball?" Apostrophe, "we danced with one another, of course, sir. But some of the girls made game to be their brothers. It was so droll." Apostrophe, "did anybody make game, to be apostrophe, to be you?" "Oh dear, yes." Apostrophe, cries Rosa, laughing with great enjoyment. "That was the first thing done.
Apostrophe, I hope she did it pretty well, apostrophe says Edwin rather doubtfully. Oh, it was excellent. I wouldn't dance with you, you know. Apostrophe, Edwin scarcely seems to see the force of this. Begs to know, if he may take the liberty to ask why? Because I was so tired of you, apostrophe returns Rosa. But she quickly adds, and pleadingly too, seeing displeasure in his face. Dear Eddie, you were just as tired of me, you know. Apostrophe, did I say so, Rosa? Apostrophe, apostrophe, say so. Do you ever say so? No, you only showed it. Oh, she did it so well. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cries Rosa, in a sudden ecstasy with her counterfeit betrothed. It strikes me that she must be a devilish impudent girl, apostrophe says Edwin Drood. And so, pussy, you have passed your last birthday in this old house. Apostrophe, ah, yes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Rosa clasps her hands, looks down with a sigh, and shakes her head. You seem to be sorry, Rosa. Apostrophe, I am sorry for the poor old place. Somehow, I feel as if it would miss me, when I am gone so far away, so young. Apostrophe, perhaps we had better stop short, Rosa? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she looks up at him with a swift bright look, next moment shakes her head, sighs, and looks down again. That is to say, is it, pussy, that we are both resigned? Apostrophe, apostrophe, she nods her head again, and after a short silence, quaintly bursts out with, you know we must be married, and married from here, Eddie, or the poor girls will be so dreadfully disappointed. Apostrophe, apostrophe, for the moment there is more of compassion, both for her and for himself, in her affianced husband's face, than there is of love. He checks the look, and asks, shall I take you out for a walk, Rosa dear? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Rosa dear does not seem at all clear on this point, until her face, which has been comically reflective, brightens. Oh, yes, Eddie, let us go for a walk. And I tell you what we'll do. You shall pretend that you are engaged to somebody else, and I'll pretend that I am not engaged to anybody, and then we shan't quarrel. Apostrophe. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.